From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. On the show, we often talk about the delicious and enticing, but what if you're in the mood for something, well, kind of off-putting or gross? Enter the Disgusting Food Museum. The museum originated in Malmö, Sweden, but it's been here in LA's Arts District over the past month. Contributor Peter Gilstrap was brave enough to visit on behalf of KCRW's Press Play.
In New York, for the person who likes to spend, there's a famous restaurant, one of the most sophisticated and expensive in the world.
That's from the 1962 Italian documentary Mondo Cane. It featured an international array of shocking cultural scenes, among them this restaurant where wealthy patrons are eating bugs and worms from plates of fine china.
While the middle-class American has to content himself with a daily steak, here the richer American can gorge himself heartily on the following delicacies: fried ants, stuffed beetles, butterfly eggs, worms au gratin, rattlesnake, muskrat, and so forth.
The freak show cuisine that stunned conventional Western palates and attitudes back then still plays today. Take Andrew Zimmern, the host of the Bizarre Food series, who can often be found on the Travel Channel putting some kind of genital into his mouth.
Mmm. I gotta tell you.
Yeah?
The snake penis is much softer and less fibrous than I thought it would be.
And now, Los Angeles has its very own version of this shock value culinary display. The nondescript brick warehouse in the Arts District that the A&D Museum occupies is the new home to the Disgusting Food Museum. It comes to us from Sweden, where it opened in November. It offers 80 exhibits, delicate dishes set out on long white tables under soft museum lights. There's fruit bat soup from Guam, fried tarantula from Cambodia, and Sardinian maggot cheese. From China, you'll see eggs boiled in the urine of virgin boys and wine sweetened with drowned baby mice. And from right here in the good old US of A, you got your pork brains in milk gravy. Step right up, folks. It's the ultimate all-you-can't-eat buffet. Or is it? Who's to say what's disgusting?
So the criteria for the museum are that the food has to be a real food. So it can't be a novelty gag gift type thing like bacon ice cream or a beer made from sexy women's vaginal yeast.
That's a thing, by the way. This is Dr. Samuel West, an organizational psychologist at Lund University in Sweden. He's also known as Dr. Failure, thanks to his previous venture, the Museum of Failure, which examined products and services gone wrong. We can all learn from mistakes, right? It was a success.
So number one is that it's a real food, and that's really important because I don't want the museum to be a freak show. And number two, it has to be disgusting. Now that's the debatable one, like who am I to decide what's disgusting? So to make it in the museum, it has to be a food that is mentioned or considered disgusting by a large amount of people.
He may not want it to be a freak show, but bear in mind that each admission comes with a complimentary barf bag, as did cult film atrocities like Tomb of the Blind Dead, A Bay of Blood, and When the Screaming Stops. And in the Swedish branch of the Disgusting Food Museum, the bags are more than just a promo gimmick.
We keep track of how many people vomited, so we're up to 11 vomits. And we only count the real, true vomits, not the spitting in bags.
And if you're keeping track, at press time, LA can boast 13 full-on vomits. Andreas Ahrens started the museum with Dr. Sam West.
I've been running tech startups for the last 20 years, and I wanted to do something fun. So me and Sam joined up and created this together.
Describe what we're looking at here.
We're looking at the tasting bar, where visitors can taste anywhere from 8 to 10 different things every day, disgusting foods, and kind of broaden their palate a bit. We will have century eggs, stinky Danish cheese, fermented shark from Iceland, and probably a couple of insects.
Have you ever had any tourists that say, hey, I'm from Guam or whatever country you're displaying, and say, hey, this isn't right. I mean, this food is not disgusting at all.
We get that every day, and that's kind of the point of the museum, to get people to not judge other cultures' foods as disgusting, but think about what do we eat that is disgusting. So we get Chinese people in that say the Chinese things are not disgusting. A lot of Swedes say that a lot of the Swedish things are not really that disgusting. Australian radio and TV, they are quite angry with us for putting Vegemite in there. So we get it all the time.
He'ile Hobart has a PhD in food studies and teaches Native and Indigenous studies at Columbia University. She's a Native Hawaiian, and though she's never been to the museum, her concerns for the exhibit's sociological message go deeper than just denigrating Vegemite.
It strikes me as really coming from a point of privilege and kind of overlooking really long histories of colonial violence against Black and brown communities whose taste for foods or limited access to particular kinds of food, colonial metropoles have often designated as disgusting in a way to also correlate ideas about cleanliness, intelligence, good taste, and things like that. I think what would be even more exciting and provocative for me is if they just rebranded the museum altogether and made it a museum of delicious foods and just kept all of the content exactly the same.
But that'd be like calling Las Vegas a place to lose money. Maybe it's more accurate, but it's not much of a come-on. And on a Sunday afternoon, there's a steady stream of people coming in, eager to huff some stinky bishop cheese or gnaw some putrefied shark meat or see a table designed to restrain a live monkey while its brain is being consumed. There are families, couples, and lots of kids. It's an ethnic melting pot of people clutching their barf bags, but they seem far more fascinated than repulsed.
No, it's not disgusting. It's unique.
Isha Sebastian came up from Orange County to check things out.
And it's interesting to understand other people's culture and understand, like, look, for instance, like, for menudo, we eat cow's intestines, right? And there's cow's intestines in this exhibit. And there's dog and there's testicles and, you know, there's other items like that. So it's not offensive once you know who you truly are. You know what I'm saying?
Aviv Wilder is 11 years old. He's just come from examining the bat soup.
How do you feel about what you're seeing?
I mean, I'm trying not to throw up and maybe sample like one or two things or more, but it is pretty gross, I must say.
He's visiting from Glendale with his mother, Lihi Shadmi.
I think it's good to be open to what other cultures are eating and just know that there's probably something here we eat that some people consider disgusting. And so part of it's a little shock value. Part of it is a good eye-opener.
Speaking of eye-openers, video screens on the walls show continuous loops of live animals being chopped, beheaded, and punctured and drained of blood, all in the name of meal prep. This is not sponsored by PETA, by the way.
I think it's interesting to see how it's done.
Sarah Flanagan is watching a video from Vietnam.
Can you describe what you're looking at right now?
Right now, this is the process of taking out a cobra heart. And they make a cocktail with vodka, and sometimes they eat it directly from the cobra, so they split the cobra in half and take out the heart while it's still beating. This doesn't disgust me as much as I thought. That's surprising.
Again, Andreas Ahrens.
We as a species, we do pretty terrible things to animals, so we kind of want to point a finger at, like, should we really treat animals this way for our own culinary pleasure? But the videos show moral disgust. We have moral disgust, we have disgusting tasting things, disgusting smelling things, and then the texture is disgusting for some of the things. But the moral is quite strong for some, the moral disgust, yeah.
But Dr. West says certain essential takeaways rise through all those options of disgust.
The reaction has been two reactions. One has been sort of a sad note. People who say they feel sad when they see how we treat animals and how short-sighted we are environmentally. You know, why don't we eat more soybeans and insects? That's one aspect. And then the others, they see it as a celebration of human creativity. Like, we can find ways to eat anything. And I mean anything. Is it poisonous? Oh, let's just dig a hole and let it rot and then eat it. We're creative and we find ways to eat things that other animals can't eat.
Whether you believe the disgusting food museum is pushing a grand Darwinian message or making a plea for alternate food sources or is simply a sensationalized tour of spectacular gross-outs, things humans eat could always be worse.
They're making our food out of people. Next thing, they'll be breeding us like cattle. For food. You gotta tell them. You gotta tell them. Silent breed is people.
The museum runs through February 17th. For KCRW, I'm Peter Gilstrap in Los Angeles.
Our thanks to Peter Gilstrap and KCRW's Press Play for sharing this piece with us. The Disgusting Food Museum ends its run at the A&D Museum on February 17th. Visit DisgustingFoodMuseum.com for tickets and info. In a moment, the mainstreaming of hippie food. More good food is on the way, so stick around. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. When I was 14, I learned how to make loaves of bread so heavy, it was a miracle they could be chewed. Not once did I think the foods so emblematic of that era could one day be signifiers of health, class, and style, like tofu sprouts, brown rice, and those whole grain breads.
I knew a lot of us had these memories about all of these foods, and I had never bothered to think about where they came from until a few years ago.
That's San Francisco food writer Jonathan Kaufman. Last year, we spoke about his book, Hippie Food. It's an absolutely fascinating read about how fringe foods went mainstream in the American diet. This is really an extraordinary document. It could be my food memoir. Did this food start in the 60s, or were there precursors? I'm thinking about Adele Davis.
Yeah, there's actually a long history of health food in America that dates back to the mid-19th century and people like Sylvester Graham, who we know because of the name Graham Crackers. But really, the health food scene in Southern California especially from the 1920s to the 1950s introduced a lot of the foods that we now associate with hippies.
Foods like what?
Foods like sprouts, smoothies, a lot of fruit juices. A carob also was something that Angelenos began eating in the 1920s.
We have to talk about carob because I had a hippie boyfriend, like a super hippie boyfriend, who as we would just walk around the city, he would stop and he would graze at carob trees. This is not a food that is inherently delicious.
No, it really isn't. I think it was a subsistence food. It is a subsistence food in parts of the Mediterranean because it grows well in desert climates. And so in the 1910s, I think, there were agricultural experiments in Southern California to plant carob trees, thinking that they would get, you know, sort of use them as a sweetener or make syrups out of the carob pods.
But alas, they were too dry and disgusting to do that with.
Yes. Yes. Unfortunately, in the 1930s, they also discovered that they sort of tasted like chocolate. And so health food stores started selling these carob sweets, and that idea caught on.
I just feel like so much of this food in its initial coming forth was just so undelicious.
Yeah, it really was. When I looked at the cookbooks from the late 1960s and even a little bit the early 70s, I wasn't really tempted to make the food because they seemed very simple, very dour. I heard lots of stories of bean and sprout casseroles. It really wasn't until the mid-70s when people like Anna Thomas and Molly Katzen and cooks like them really created a much more colorful, internationally influenced cuisine.
So let's talk about that. You talk about the summer of 1970 and what was going on that caused a deluge of young people to fly all over the place.
So in the late 60s, the airline industry across the United States spent millions and millions of dollars on upgrading both airlines and airports to accommodate jumbo jets. And they increased the capacity for travel, and then they had to fill the planes. And so they started offering all of these cheap fares to Europe. And you could actually take a flight where they would serve margaritas and play rock and roll, or you could fly to Iceland for $99 and then get across to the continent. And traveling to Europe became a middle class, a rite of passage for a lot of college kids.
I had a ticket that lasted a year for $120.
Wow.
In 1970.
And, you know, you had all these kids piling into European countries and, like, sleeping on lawns and, you know, clumping up in squares, smoking marijuana. And in the governments of these countries didn't even know what to do with all of the young Americans who were kind of taking over the cities.
This group of kids managed to start foraging ingredients that still today are sort of markers of simple European eating in a way that has tremendous cachet. It's just so odd.
Yeah, I think because they were so poor, or they were just traveling on the cheap, they really were eating the food that was around them, and they fell for, you know, the farmers markets or, you know, find just the pleasures of simple, good bread. where previous generations of Americans or even their parents would have traveled to hotels and been kind of removed from the food of the countries around them.
Let's go back to talk a little bit about sort of the organic triumvirate, not meaning organic the way we think of it today, but let's talk about tofu for a minute and politics. What was the role that tofu played?
Well, tofu has been made in California since the mid-19th century, but it largely stayed in Japanese and Chinese American communities. In 1971, a UC Berkeley student named Francis Moore LePay dropped out of school in order to research this problem of poverty. She was really concerned about the roots of poverty and started studying agricultural reports to see if America could feed itself in the face of famine or if the world could. And she discovered that we were feeding huge amounts of corn and grain and soybeans to animals instead of people. And that in fact, if we just went vegetarian, it could eradicate global famine.
This sounds so familiar, doesn't it?
Oh, we're still hearing, we're hearing this rhetoric again today with Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger folks who are trying to come up with these good-tasting meat substitutes. So for her, soybeans were kind of the perfect vegetable protein. William Shurtleff and Akiko Ayagi, who were living in Japan, decided that tofu would be kind of this food that could feed the world. And so they researched and wrote a book called The Book of Tofu and then spent 6 months traveling around the United States. And every place they stopped to give a presentation about tofu, a small tofu making collective set up.
That's extraordinary. So what's really fascinating to me are how these foods sort of switched from being these marginalized, degraded foods by the larger culture and yet became totally embedded in the food culture, the mass market food culture.
I think part of that is because they stuck around. It was this sort of longevity. And so generations like me who grew up with them a little bit and may have poo-pooed them and kind of moved away from them for a time came back to them later. But also, what really became clear as I was researching the book is that the ideas about what healthy food was that emerged in the 1970s became the template that everyone adopted. You know, in 1970, nutritionists were saying, oh, whole wheat bread and white bread have, you know, they're about the same amount. They're both good for you as long as you eat a balanced diet. And now the USDA is recommending that we get half of our grains from whole grains.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've learned how to make those breads a lot more deliciously.
Yes. When I eat tartine bread, and it's made by Tartine Bakery, and it's just this beautiful, light, airy, flavorful sourdough bread that's really crusty. Oh, I love it. It's my favorite.
So let's talk about money and government and the word organic. Eventually, this word organic morphed and started to mean something. What kind of money was there to be made in the organic agriculture business?
There was very little money at the beginning. It was very much a fringe pursuit from the 1940s when the term organic was introduced by J.I. Rodale to the United States to the 1970s when Back to the Landers moved to rural areas. And because they had these ideas, these interests in natural food and avoiding pesticides, they began farming organically and buying organic produce. But it was very much a small thing where, you know, if you were a farmer, you were sort of selling to a niche group of people like you. It wasn't until the 90s when the USDA adopted, you know, organic certification standards and people began realizing you could make a lot of money by charging a premium for organic produce that, you know, the industry took off.
So when you walk into a Whole Foods or a Sprouts today, these grocery chains that focus on natural foods, what do you think when you walk through them?
I think about how much money is involved in this industry now. And it was such a ragtag affair for so many years. I'm really also impressed at how many products they have. Organic food or natural foods was such a small industry back in the 1970s. In fact, they didn't like a lot of processed food. And now we have so many different kinds of vegetables, so many different kinds of processed foods, so many things for sale. It looks much more appetizing than I think a 1975 co-op would have looked.
That was San Francisco Chronicle food writer Jonathan Kaufman talking to me last year. His book is called Hippie Food, How Back to the Landers, Long Hairs, and Revolutionaries Changed the Way We Eat. It's now available in paperback. Speaking of hippies, have you met Hippie Jack? He's a colorful guy with strong opinions about sweets, and he happens to be a good friend of our contributor, Gideon Brower. Gideon says that if the dude from The Big Lebowski was a food critic, he might sound like Jack. Last year, the two went on a mission to find the best waffle in Los Angeles. Here it is, in case you missed it.
My friend Jack the Hippie was in town a few weeks ago. Jack was born in D.C., and he spent most of his life there. But he identifies as a Californian for the simple reason that he loves it here. He first came to Los Angeles for college in 1964, and he earned his hippie credentials in San Francisco in the late 60s. Ever since then, California has been the promised land for Jack, and he visits as often as he can. In the old days, he'd drive here cross-country in his brightly painted Volkswagen bus. These days, he flies in and rents a Prius. One of the things Jack loves about L.A. is the food. His eclectic list of favorite spots includes Jody Moroni's Sausage Kingdom, The Real Inn on PCH, and the Whole Foods mothership in Venice. Last year, we visited a dozen bakeries in search of the perfect chocolate chip cookie. So when he suggests we turn our attention to waffles, I set aside a full day for driving and tasting. On my calendar, I just write, waffles. Jack's in his 70s now, and he recently had a hip replacement. But he still starts his day with the three-hour routine of kundalini yoga, pranayama, and chanting that's been part of his life for decades. When I pick him up for our waffle odyssey, I find him sitting on the floor just winding up his morning ritual. At the outset, Jack tells me he'll be measuring every waffle we taste today against something called the Green Sherman. To me, the Green Sherman sounds like a friendly Jewish monster from a children's book. But for Jack, it's a legendary waffle made by friends in Seattle that he's known for more than 40 years.
Jane Sherman made the original batch, but her husband took over, John Green. It's got three eggs in it, and it's made with yogurt, and they add melted butter, and they throw in a little sugar. And when I first had one, it had banana in it, too, and sometimes pecans. And they're so good, and they're so substantial that you feel like you're kind of in a coma when you finish eating these hippie waffles.
I asked Jack about the first time he tried the Green Sherman.
And I was staying in their driveway in my bus. Air was fresh, the kids were little. We were still young.
I've mapped out 8 stops for today's trip, based on some waffle-centric blog posts. I asked Jack what for him makes a waffle good or great.
I would want it to have a beautiful color, a dark color, even with patches of almost burnt. And a tangy flavor. Even though you put syrup on it, it still has that hoppy lightness and deliciousness to it. It's not overpowering and not too candy-ish and dessert-ish. You definitely want it to be crispy around the edges and cooked all the way through. And it should be hot, too. That counts for a lot.
Our tour starts at The Waffle on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. This breakfast food mecca has a whole menu of waffles to choose from. There's also a bar here on the mezzanine level.
Not every waffle shop has a full bar. So you can get drunk and you don't have to go to the Waffle House on the way home, you just come downstairs.
You're absolutely right. You get your hangover food the same place you get your hangover.
Our multi-grain waffle arrives with a mysterious dollop that turns out to be vanilla yogurt.
This waffle is kind of a little bit undercooked and it has some gumminess to it,
yeah. You know.
But it's also got a little bit of crunch, like there's some nuts.
It's got sort of an oatmeal-y flavor.
And I'm sure there's sugar in the batter because it's very sweet. I'm not putting any of this syrup on it. And the flavor is not bad. I'm actually liking this. But we've got a lot more waffles ahead of us. We've got to stop.
Yeah. This is like a nap on a plate.
Our Our next stop is a classic, Roscoe's House of Chicken and Waffles, at its original location on North Gower. You can get a solo waffle here, but we decide to order a piece of fried chicken, too. By itself, the Roscoe's waffle is lacking.
It doesn't have a brilliant texture. It's not nice and dark on the top. The grid, the little squares are teeny, it's thin. Yeah, it tastes like a certain kind of cookie.
And yet, with the chicken, it really works.
Before I walked in here, I thought the idea of a chicken and waffle was gross. Now I totally get it.
The chicken provides the crunch that the waffle lacks.
I could eat this whole thing if I had a hangover or if I was drunk. Or even sober, I could have gone through this whole thing happily. I'm rolling now, I'm ready to go to another one.
Okay.
This meat really picked me up. I love this part of Hollywood. Look at Amoeba Music, it's so cool. And I love the Cinerama Theater.
Yeah.
You look down there and there's those courtyards just like in Chinatown. Love that.
Driving with Jack in Los Angeles is often a sentimental journey into the past.
I just love it here. It has very much the same look and feel as it did when I arrived in 64.
Has the food scene changed a lot in LA?
Oh, yeah.
What did you eat when you were here before? Did you not care?
I didn't care. I eat chili dogs from the Doggy Diner on the corner of Van Nuys and Fulton. I had my first taco at the Jack in the Box on Coldwater Canyon in the valley in North Hollywood. Greasy. I think they're still the same.
Jack was back in LA in the mid-80s and early 90s. He had a bunch of different jobs then, including hosting a weekly music show on KCRW. It didn't pay anything, but making money has never meant a lot to Jack.
By that time, I had my own bus, and I was volunteering at KCRW.
Okay.
And living on cups of noodles from the little cupboard there in the main office. I don't know if they have that anymore. ACMACs and cups of noodles. And then I started getting house-sitting gigs from the people I met. And so then I was really swinging because I was living in one nice place or another and sometimes making a little route every day. All the people who were out of town whose cats and dogs needed watering. And if I was ever in between house-sitting gigs, I could sleep in my Volkswagen.
The Shaky Alibi is a cafe near the Grove that calls itself a coffee bar and wafflery. Their specialty is a Liège waffle, a Belgian variant made from yeast dough and coated with chunks of pearl sugar.
Oh, this is gross. It's just like pure sugar. Oh, it's disgustingly sweet. I would certainly never order this again.
Our next stop, IHOP, formerly known, of course, as the International House of Pancakes.
This is so institutional. This is like something you get at the old folks' home.
Jack's IHOP review, which started out negative, gets even worse once we leave.
It had the flavor of something manufactured from the material loaded by a 12-inch hose into the kitchen from a tanker truck. Manufactured originally in Iowa next to a slaughterhouse. Using water that leached out from the cesspool next to the slaughterhouse.
You really missed your calling as a food critic. You probably would have been murdered by now.
Next up is Hayden in the Platform Development in Culver City. This place has a curated feel, from the Instagram-friendly decor to the world music soundtrack to the buckwheat waffle served on a handcrafted plate.
There's some vegetable flavor. Like they used a bowl that had a salad in it.
The edge is actually burned, which is to your liking.
I love that. It has a beautiful color. It tastes like a fresh loaf of artisanal bread, kind of.
It is bready.
It definitely doesn't taste like it came out of a hose, out of a tanker truck.
maybe an artisanal hose.
Our next scheduled stop is the waffle restaurant called Brew's Wiffle.
Closed today.
Which turns out to be closed on Mondays.
Okay, downtown we go.
Downtown.
So we head downtown, still searching for a waffle to rival the great Green Sherman.
I had a girlfriend who lived right down there on the left in a little apartment building. Raven-haired girl who went to Bryn Mawr. And she finally married somebody else. I played guitar at their wedding.
Poppy and Rose is a bustling cafe tucked into a corner of the sprawling Los Angeles flower market. We sit at the counter and order a waffle, which Jack quickly dubs generic.
It tastes like a pancake.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I should stop eating now, but I'm tempted to keep going just because it's so yummy.
I'm going
to
eat this last corner. And then
I'm going to have one more bite, and I swear to God, I'm going to stop eating.
Our last stop is G&B Coffee in the Grand Central Market downtown. Prepared behind a large rectangular counter, this yeasted rectangular waffle comes on a rectangular plate with a small knob of butter and a thimble-sized serving of maple syrup. We review our findings in the parking garage.
It could not have been better, really. It was crusty. It had a beautiful color. It was light. It had a yeasty tang. But it was not the Green Sherman waffle, which to me is still the standard. But so much depends on, you know, the romance of the past and the idealization of when you first encounter something really fine.
Which is why, in the end, there's no beating the Green Sherman. Like the streets of Los Angeles, it's a part of Jack's past. A waffle whose key ingredients, along with yogurt, oats, and bananas, are youth, adventure, and the easy companionship of old friends. For Good Food, I'm Gideon Brower.
My thanks to Gideon Brower and his friend Jack for taking us on their waffle quest. This piece was made possible by the Independent Producer Project. For the Green Sherman waffle recipe, visit the Good Food blog. That's blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, a look at the ins and outs of restaurant hospitality with Will Guidara of 11 Madison Park and the Nomad. Don't go anywhere. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman.
Creating amazing experiences for people when they walk through our doors is one of the most affirming and uplifting and energizing things. I believe in the nobility of serving other people.
That was Will Guidara talking to me a year ago. Along with Chef Daniel Hume, he's the restaurateur behind 11 Madison Park in New York, which has been called the best restaurant in the world. Hospitality is Will Guidara's obsession. If you've been watching the Netflix show 7 Days Out, then you've seen that zeal in action. In one episode, a camera crew closely follows him and his team over a stressful week leading up to 11 Madison Park's reopening. Guidara's hospitality group also includes the Nomad Hotel and Bar, which opened a location in downtown LA last year. Around that time, I spoke with Will about the experiences he hopes to create for diners. What really strikes me about those of you who are coming out from New York to LA, you're in a bit of a different position because you've actually lived out here before. Who did you work for when you were out here the first time around?
Well, so my dad used to run a company called Restaurant Associates in New York. And when I was a junior in high school, he moved out to be the CEO of the Wolfgang Puck Food Company. So that wasn't the company that ran Spago. They did all the expresses and the cafes and that entire suite of restaurants and products. And so I never lived out here full-time, but I was here every summer during my, you know, winter breaks. And so I was a line cook at Aubergine, Wolfgang's restaurant on, I think it was Cannon. And then I was a busboy at Spago in Beverly Hills. And we lived here in Santa Monica, actually. And yeah, I mean, that's when I fell in love with this place. I loved being a busboy at Spago. Just, you know, I mean, for a kid who, from the age of 12, wanted to be in the restaurant business, getting to bus tables at Spago, it's like a dream come true. I think I was 16 or 17 years old. And
did that solidify your love of the front of the house rather than...
Well, I always wanted to be in the dining room. I never wanted to work in the kitchen. I worked as a line cook at Aubergine only because, and I did, I worked as an accountant. I've worked as a purchaser, as a cook, only because I wanted to understand the entire business so I could succeed in the path that I chose. But for me, the dining room was always where I wanted to be. I love the ability to create those magical experiences for people that walk through our doors. And in the dining room, you get the instant gratification of looking at the expression on people's faces when you create them. And so, no, that didn't solidify it. It had already been solidified. But I think every job I've had since I started down this path just got me more excited to do what I'm doing.
So you have this 3-star Michelin restaurant in New York that's been named the number one restaurant in the world. And I think about the kind of service and the attention to detail and the level of perfection involved in that kind of an enterprise. And then I think about the way most of us eat, not even saying the word dine, but the way most of us eat here in Los Angeles, it's a very, very different culture. Have you thought about, I mean, you must have thought about the impression of diners and what you're hoping to bring to them, and if you're importing a New York culture, or are you creating something new?
Well, so Nomad, even in New York, is very different from what 11 Madison Park is. Each one of our restaurants is meant to hold some place in people's lives. If 11 Madison Park is where you go once a year, perhaps to celebrate an amazing moment or to give yourself the grace to forget a difficult one. Nomad was always meant for us to be our perfect night out on the town, a place where, you know, it had the same pursuit of excellence and hospitality as 11 Madison Park, but was louder, looser. We have musical inspirations for our restaurants. 11 Madison Park is Miles Davis. The Nomad is the Rolling Stones. And I think that helps to explain it. There was always a distinction between those two restaurants. When we brought Nomad out here, we never intended for it to be a carbon copy of New York. I think there's a balance there. We want to add something to the conversation of restaurants in Los Angeles, but we also want Los Angeles to add something to the conversation of the restaurants in our company. We want to bring a little bit of New York with us, but we didn't just decide to open another restaurant. We decided we wanted to be in Los Angeles, and then we brought Nomad here.
It's interesting, too, that you started, like, your public face in L.A. was a truck.
Yeah. Well, no, I think we did that for a few reasons. I think French chefs coming to New York is the equivalent of New York restaurateurs coming to Los Angeles in the sense that people come in with all this bravado and thinking, we're going to teach you how it's done, and that's just not how we feel at all.
We tend to spit out people who do that.
Yeah, and I think understandably so. We wanted to humbly introduce ourselves to the city. We wanted to get to know the city. And I think one of the main parts about the truck was giving ourselves the opportunity to collaborate with so many amazing chefs and restaurateurs out here. You know, I love what we do because of the community that exists in our industry. And it just seemed impossible to us, the idea of opening a restaurant out here without first having spent a year with our team out here getting to know the people and the places. And we also knew that, and whatever success we've gained in New York, that doesn't mean anyone out here knows who we are. And it was so funny, a couple times some people would say to our team running the truck, hey, this is pretty cool. You guys should open a brick and mortar. And we were like, all right, this was definitely the right thing to do. But it was a really enriching experience, and I'm so happy that we did it.
You know, I watched the Welcome Conference presentation that Ewan and Daniel did, who's your partner in the business. Your friendship is so apparent. It's so palpable. You nearly find a kind of marital delight in one another, which is so rare. How much of your success in retooling the business when the two of you came together do you attribute to the fact that you found one another?
I think 100% of our success. Daniel is my business partner. He's my best friend. He has siblings, but there was a pretty significant age gap between him and his siblings, and so he was kind of like an only child as well. And so the two of us are as close to being brothers to one another than we've had. You know, early on, when we first met, we talked about what we wanted in our relationship and in the restaurant. I used to want to be in fine dining for a long time, but I stopped wanting to be in fine dining because I had spent my life pursuing the craft of service, and I found myself in a chef-driven industry running around trying to convince the person in the back that what I cared about mattered as much as what he or she cared about. And when Daniel and I met, we decided that the best way to run the restaurant was from both sides of the wall. Inevitably, a restaurateur-driven restaurant will make decisions based on what's best for the dining room. A chef-driven restaurant will make those same decisions based on what's best for the kitchen. But if it's 50-50, with all the tension that inevitably comes with that type of partnership, you make decisions based on what's best for the restaurant as a whole.
That was my conversation with restaurateur Will Guidara from last year. Last year, he and Chef Daniel Hume opened the Nomad Hotel and Bar in downtown L.A. On a more somber note, the patriarch of Cantor's Deli, Alan Cantor, passed away this week at the age of 82. After a short break, we're looking at what delis like Cantor's mean to Los Angeles. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Now, a sad moment for L.A.'s deli culture. This week, Alan Cantor of Cantor's Deli on Fairfax passed away at the age of 82. Growing up, Cantor's was a second home for me and my mom. For 20 years, my mom walked through the doors at Cantor's to start her day with a burnt bagel with cream cheese and a cup of black coffee. It's a quirky and familiar place that, for me, embodies the best of L.A. In 2009, back when my mom was still with us, I spoke with the author David Sachs about why Jewish delis like Cantor's are so special. He had written a book on the subject called Save the Deli. Here's that conversation.
Is it really going to go away?
As long as your mother is alive, I don't think so. That's for sure, from the sounds of it. Where is she from?
Philadelphia.
Wonderful. God bless her. It is, as you said, in danger. There were once thousands of delis in New York City alone, and now there's but 24, more or less. And the same trend is true in a lot of other cities, such as Philadelphia or Chicago, Toronto, Montreal, Florida, Miami. And a number of factors have caused the decline of this once numerous and plentiful institution to something that's endangered and requires someone like your mother to go ever so often to keep it alive.
Why don't you describe what type of delis in particular we're talking about?
We're specifically talking about Jewish delicatessens, which refers to the foods of the Eastern European or Ashkenazi Jews, the meat foods. So not so much the cream cheeses and the bagels and the herrings, but pastrami, corned beef, salami, brisket, kishka, matzah ball soup, the things that you would find in places like Katz's in New York or Cantor's in Los Angeles, these temples of salted and cured meats where the shtick flies as fast as the blade on the slicing machine.
You say it's dying and many are closing. Why do you think?
There's a number of reasons. Most of them have to do with sort of the evolution of the Jewish community and Jewish tastes. Once upon a time, this was the food that every Eastern European Jew who came to this country and others ate on a daily basis. This was a three-meal-a-day food. This was their diet. And one element of it was assimilation, that as successive generations of American Jews grew up with no connection to Eastern Europe, this food became a part of their past, and they started discovering other foods, Chinese food, Italian food, French food, Thai food. And the deli went from being something that you ate at on a regular basis to something that was eaten at more and more occasionally. And then another element of that, of course, is the health trend element, which is in the 1980s, you all of a sudden couldn't eat any fat. It was going to kill you. And then all of a sudden, you couldn't eat any bread. It was going to kill you in the 1990s. And now today, it's you can't eat any salt. It's going to kill you. We're constantly being told by doctors and health professionals that deli is going to kill us for one reason or another. Meanwhile, people still go on eating deli and they live fine lives as long as they do so in moderation.
Well, I have to just say that my mother is 89.
And may she live to be 210.
Exactly. And she seems to thrive on a diet of nitrates and smoke.
Well, she's preserved. She's literally preserved.
A lot of us in America, when we think about sort of the premier delis, obviously Katz's is in New York is sort of up there as the king. But you say in the book that Los Angeles has become a really big deli city.
Yeah, no surprise. It has the second largest Jewish population, so it has the numbers for it. And it also has a culture which incubates deli. Whereas if you go to the Carnegie Delicatessen in New York and the Stage Delicatessen, the Times Square Delicatessens, they're filled with photos of famous people on the walls. And if you go to Nate Nowes or Cantor's in Los Angeles or Factor's or Froman's or Izzy's, all Los Angeles delis, you'll see the faces sitting in the booths. The deli is very much tied to the entertainment industry, and the entertainment industry in Los Angeles has a decidedly Jewish flavor to it. At Arts and Studio City, you'll get Steven Spielberg having a breakfast meeting. You'll have Ivan Reitman there eating lox, eggs, and onions and taking script meetings with people. It's tied into the culture of the city and the fabric of the city, and because of that, it's not a nostalgic thing. No one goes there to take a photo of a booth. They sit there in their day-to-day, and when something's day-to-day, the quality level needs to reflect that because the customers are coming back on a daily or weekly basis.
Now, there were some places that you discovered that you would expect to find good deli because of their large Jewish population, but you were disappointed.
The most glaring one is sort of South Florida, the Miami Beach area and that whole coast, which is the third largest population of Jews in the United States. And many retirees who came down from cities such as Philadelphia and New York and Toronto to live in the Sunshine Coast. And there are a large number of delis, but I wasn't overwhelmed. It wasn't that they were bad. It wasn't that the food was inedible. There were some good deli, but it wasn't anything that was a revelation. And I think a lot of it was because these places were really just trafficking a lot on the idea of a nostalgia, a certain idea of, you know, it was this way in Brooklyn in 1950, and, you know, this is the way it's going to be, and this is what we're trying to recapture. And then the other thing that I found with that, with Florida, was that there were a lot of what I'll call bagel delis, which is a bagel store and bagel place mixed with a delicatessen. And you can't wear two hats at once. It's very difficult. Making a great bagel is a feat in itself. It takes tremendous dedication and time and work and concentration. And then to add deli on top of that, one of those things is going to suffer. And I generally found that the deli end of things wasn't as good.
Now, what are two ingredients that when you see them in a deli, you just shake your head and say, boy, those don't belong here?
Loaves of white bread and glasses of milk, I would probably say. That it's the classic joke. I feel it's a Jackie Mason routine. Probably sushi or pizza, anything that really doesn't relate to either that Eastern European Jewish tradition or, if not that, then at least your basic diner food. Mayonnaise is actually kosher. It's parv, so it's made from eggs and oil. So it can, in Jewish law, go on a pastrami sandwich. But in my law, in the law of good taste, it should never.
That was author David Sacks talking with me in 2009 about his book, Save the Deli. I wrote a remembrance of Alan Cantor that you can find on the KCRW website. Visit blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Now, the market report. Take us out of here, Laura.
This is Laura Avery with the market report. I'm happy to be visiting for the first time with Luca Mandarino. He is chef owner of Sosta restaurant in Hermosa Beach. So, Luca, what are you shopping for today?
Well, today I came, this is Luca Mandarino. Today I came for fennel and pink grapefruit, beautiful season for it. And one of the things that I was saying before when we were chatting is that I'm so glad that finally everybody's knowing fennel, because 5 years ago, nobody knew what it was. So I do a salad that it's truly the pure expression of both ingredients. So it's just fennel, pink grapefruit, olive oil, salt, pepper, a little bit of vinegar.
Is this a traditionally Italian dish? Is fennel a thing in Italy?
Absolutely, yes. Oh. Fennel is very traditionally Italian.
What is the Italian word for fennel?
Finocchio.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Is it a seasonal dish?
Yes, winter, okay. Definitely winter.
Definitely.
Especially because you wanted to have the grapefruit, it's either pink or red, mm-hmm. which is only winter. You yeah. know, like the same thing with oranges. So.
But in Italy, obviously, it's not a citrus growing area. Where do you get the grapefruit in Italy in winter?
Southern Italy. Northern Italy, we have more blood orange. Than anything else, uh-huh. you know. But, you know, you can find it throughout Italy.
But fennel is everywhere in Italy.
Fennel is everywhere.
Yeah, okay.
It is a big deal. I mean, we put them in so many dishes, mm-hmm. you know. So that's why I said 5 years ago when I couldn't, nobody knew when I was asking mm-hmm. what was fennel. They were laughing at me.
Yeah, you come to the States and nobody knows anything about it, right?
Nothing, you know. Until it explodes, like everything in the United States.
Yeah.
It goes crazy and they do everything with it.
Cavallonero. Nobody had ever heard of it. Tuscan kale,
exactly.
Black kale. It's everywhere.
Even though my mom used to say kale, she said, they eat kale? She said, do you know that we give that to the pigs?
It probably grows like a weed.
It does.
Well, the pigs have good taste.
No, they do.
Yeah, they do.
Definitely. Definitely.
So what about the dish you're making with the grapefruit and the fennel?
The fennel is, I was mentioning before, it has to have a little bit of thickness. If it's too thin, it loses completely the property of licorice part. It's gone. So it's a little thick. It can be slightly chewy, but that's the characteristic of it. And then I squeeze a little bit of the juice of the pink grapefruit. Mm. I use part of the pulp. And then I add olive oil, salt, pepper, a little bit of vinegar and lemon. Not too much, otherwise the citrus will take over the taste of the fennel.
Grapefruit slices with the fennel on the salad?
Yes, so completely skin off the grapefruit, mm-hmm. even the little thin skin around.
Yeah,
and the slice.
Yes.
Yeah,
pith. Yeah, la pelle.
La pelle.
La pelle del polpelmo, that's what we call it.
Okay.
And then I take it in pieces, a little bit of pieces, and I put them inside, mixed with the salad.
Mm. Well, this is lovely, and it's really, a lot of people don't know what to do with a grapefruit. They
yes.
appreciate how it looks, and they think they should get one or have it for breakfast, but I love that you're mixing it up with the fennel.
And I also say, just get a slice with the pith off.
Yeah.
And even by itself, just with a little bit of olive oil and salt, it is to die for. And if it's by itself, I use a little bit of rock salt.
Yeah.
You have the crunch, and then it kind of like explodes in your mouth. So it's beautiful.
All right. Well, Chef, it was so delicious talking to you, learning some new words in Italian. And your restaurant is called Sosta.
Yes.
What does that mean?
Sosta means the resting place.
Wonderful.
Thank
well, it's great to
much.
See you up
thank
here.
Thank you very much. Thank
nice
you. Thank
to
you.
You.
Thank
that was chef owner Luca Mandarino of Sosta Restaurant down in Hermosa Beach, and he's celebrating, as we all do, the bounty of our never-ending seasonal offerings here at the market. I'm talking now with Shu Takakawa, who is the owner, along with his wife Debbie, of The Garden Of. It's an organic farm located in Los Olivos, and Shu and Debbie and Garden Of are just renowned for the absolute beauty of the vegetables that they grow. And Shu, we've talked to you before about your little gems, your beautiful little lettuces. But today, Chef Luca was very impressed with your fennel. So can you tell us all about how you grow your fennel, what the season is, and why yours is so very good?
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. So fennel has been my kind of passion to grow. And so I try many different way to grow because I seen nice picture in the seed catalog.
Yeah.
I tried direct seed. I got seed from Italy and a few varieties. I planted direct seed. I thought this cannot be transplanted because it's a taproot. So I planted, right? Then baby fennels.
Yeah.
And so here's a story. There's a woman from Italy. Oh. She came up to my stand. Then she saw that.
Baby fennel. Baby.
Then she said, American eat anything. We feed to the pig.
Oh.
So then next season, I grew a very good one. Then she came. Then she just talked. Oh, she even picked up. Then she just tossed it. Then she said, still American eat anything.
Now, were these bigger? Were these bigger fennel now?
Yeah, that was the big one I could grow. And also not round like I have now. And so that was the seeds from the Italy, but it's open pollinated. So I transplant and I plant every 8 inches more space, then airflow, and then I have nice round.
Bigger.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then the women come back.
Third year.
I wasn't there that time. Uh-huh. Then my daughter-in-law was there. Then she said, shoot. She picked up the three. She bought it, actually. Then yes. we just totally like this. Everybody.
That's what she was looking for.
So she's the one actually made me better fennel farmers.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, the big fennel you have now, are we just starting the season? How long will you have it?
That big? Mm-hmm. I think lasts 1 month or so.
Oh, okay.
And then getting even better for the, this rain.
Uh-huh.
And so...
Are you planting another planting to get more fennel later in the summer?
I have one already started, uh-huh. and then that's it for a fennel season for the early spring.
All right, Shu. Well, it's so amazing talking to you and how much attention you pay to how you grow and what you grow up there. And your produce absolutely shows what a good farmer you are. So we love having you here.
Well, thank you so much.
All right. Well, that was Shu Takakawa, and his farm is called The Garden Of, and he's here on Wednesdays. You can also find him at the Hollywood Farmers Market, and where else?
Santa Barbara.
Oh, in Santa Barbara. Okay, right. And he comes down from Los Olivos, and we're very happy to have him, and check out his booth. It's covered with ladybug banners. You can't miss it. For The Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
That's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, leave us a review if you like the show. My thanks to the Good Food team, Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.